Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bruce Ackerman, a constitutional law professor at Yale University, who explains why he considers the Supreme Court decision overturning the Bush administration's plan to subject detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to military tribunals to be truly historic. Michael Letteri of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who discusses the uncertain results of Mexico's July 2nd presidential election. And BBC reporter and author Greg Palast, who examines White House attacks, singling out the New York Times after three papers reported that the Bush administration had gained secret access to international financial transaction records. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Washington Post reports Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai is facing a crisis of political confidence due to growing attacks by Taliban fighters, widespread corruption, and frayed relations with European nations. Karzai's popularity fell rapidly after his landslide election in October 2004. The president is now engaged in a war of words with Western allies whose support was vital to his rise to power after the defeat of the Taliban in late 2001. At a press conference in late June, Karzai attacked his Western backers for ignoring his plans to rebuild local security forces. He also called on Western military advisers to look outside of Afghanistan's borders for the cause of recent Taliban attacks. Since April, Taliban fighters have killed over 600 people, and civilians who are cooperating with the U.S.-led government and coalition forces have been threatened. In recent weeks, Karzai also received heavy criticism for naming 13 police officials, many of whom face allegations of human rights abuses. Western advisers complained it demonstrated political and ethnic favoritism rather than creating a professionally run police force. European officials in particular are fearful of a return to Islamic or tribal paramilitaries after 4 years of attempts to disarm local militias. As one Western diplomat complained to the Washington Post, "Nearly 5 years on, there is no rule of law, there is no accountability. The Afghans know all of this is a charade. You cannot fight a war on terror and build a weak state at the same time." China is quickly becoming the prime small arms supplier to repressive regimes in the developing world, such as Burma and Sudan. According to Amnesty International and independent military authorities, China's billion-dollar arms trade is the main military sponsor of Burma, whose repressive regime has kept Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest for most of the last 16 years. Specifically, China has sold Burma artillery, trucks, and logistical support. China is also the prime military supplier to Sudan, involved in the genocide taking place in Darfur, resulting in the deaths of over 300,000 people. China has supplied the Khartoum government with fighter aircraft and helicopters. China has also employed sales of cheap arms as a key element in expanding trade and development ties in Africa and Latin America. As Paul Beaver, a London-based military analyst, told the BBC, "It's the country of choice when you want to buy cheap and simple weapons, like Kalashnikovs, rocket-propelled grenades, and artillery shells." 24 pilot whales began to beach themselves unexpectedly last January near Cape Hatteras in North Carolina. 6 of the whales were pregnant, and 15 died. A few days later, minke and sperm whales beached themselves nearby. Scientists quickly tried to figure out what led to the deaths. As Connie Barclay of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration told Mother Jones magazine, "It's curious to have 3 different kinds of whales strand." But further investigation revealed that the U.S. Navy was conducting submarine hunting drills the same day off North Carolina's Outer Banks. They broadcast loud sonar sounds across the Atlantic Ocean, which can be as loud as a Saturn V rocket taking off, or more than 230 decibels. The Navy insists its exercises had nothing to do with the death of the whales, but this was not the first incident. In 2000, dozens of whales beached themselves in the Bahamas and the Canary Islands near the site of U.S. Navy and NATO sonar exercises. Last year, a United Nations report concluded increased naval military exercises had harmed the ability of 71 types of whales, dolphins, and porpoises to navigate and hunt. In 2003, the Natural Resources Defense Council won a court case restricting the Navy's use of new low-frequency sonar. Predictably, the Bush administration responded by pushing through Congress a bill to exempt the Pentagon from key provisions of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
On June 29th, the Supreme Court ruled that President George Bush's plan to try detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by military tribunal is unconstitutional and that it violates both the U.S. Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Conventions, of which the U.S. is a signatory. Many of the more than 500 prisoners have been held there for more than 4 years as enemy combatants in the White House War on Terror. One of them is Osama bin Laden's one-time driver, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, whose attorneys appealed the case to the Supreme Court. In Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, five justices ruled against the administration's position. Justices Scalia, Alito, and Thomas backed the administration, while Chief Judge John Roberts recused himself because he had ruled in the earlier appellate court decision on the case supporting the Bush administration's position. After the court's ruling, some Democrats in Congress called for the creation of an independent commission to review the administration's often unilateral anti-terrorism measures, while Republican leaders said they would seek to authorize military commissions at Guantanamo and restrict application of the Geneva Conventions to terrorism suspects. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Bruce Ackerman, a constitutional law professor at Yale University Law School, shortly after the Supreme Court ruling. Ackerman explains why he filed a friend of the court brief in the Hamdan case and why he considers this Supreme Court decision to be truly historic.
First of all, we have to make a distinction between real wars, like those in Afghanistan and Iraq, and a metaphor called the War on Terror. Terror is a technique. It's the destruction of innocent human beings. We do not declare war on techniques. Once you start declaring war on a technique, you don't have to define who the enemy is. And so the detainees in Guantanamo, some of them are detainees in real wars, and some of them are in this amorphous problem, and it's a serious problem that people are conspiring to blow up American buildings and things of this kind. This is not a war. This is really a problem having to do with the free market in death. That is to say, the state is losing its monopoly on methods of mass destruction. In the next 50 years, it'll become cheaper and cheaper for smaller and smaller groups to buy terrible weapons. What was assassination was in the 20th century, these terrible events will occur, and we have to have a new legal structure when they occur that doesn't have to do with war, but has to do with trying to prevent the second strike. Because, of course, if something terrible happens, we should act in an emergency way to try to disrupt the second strike for a short period of time. And what has happened here is that the actions the president took right after September 11th, which might have been reasonable as short-term emergency measures, are then propelled into a new definition of normality. And Guantanamo is a symbol of that insofar as the people, many of the detainees, were not caught on any battlefield. And then they find themselves in this bureaucratic nightmare. And we have to have a new emergency constitution, as I call it. And to handle the problem of the second strike, which is actually going to occur from time to time, but for a temporary period, and to take steps to make sure that what's happened in this case, which is that a temporary crisis has led to the redefinition of normality forever, will never happen again.
So what do you think Bush's next step will be? Do you think he will actually follow this decision?
The president has already conceded that Guantanamo should be closed in principle. So I'm absolutely sure that the president will follow through on this opinion. And what this opinion requires is that he obey the rule of law, that he not create just out of nothing new forms of justice. You know, these tribunals did not give them the detainees a right to be present at the trials in which their fate was going to be determined. So this was very radical stuff. The Supreme Court decision quite clearly establishes a baseline of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the same procedures we use for our own servicemen, for those who were caught on the battlefield or involved in a real war in Afghanistan or Iraq. And I have no doubt that the president will follow this unless and until he goes to Congress and tries to persuade them that special and new statutory solutions are necessary. And the best thing about that, of course, is not only the statutory solution, but he'll have to actually talk pragmatically and sensibly to the American people and try to explain to them what new laws are required rather than simply take unilateral action on their own.
You filed a brief in this case this past January in support of Hamdan's case against the government, and you filed it with a very conservative law professor from the University of Chicago.
And he and I almost never agree on anything. And we filed this brief together to emphasize that this case was not an ordinary case. It really is one of the historic decisions that the Supreme Court has handed down over two centuries, and they decided it the right way. And that's the important point, to have rubber-stamped these extreme claims to unilateral presidential authority would have been a tragedy.
Do you think this will be like Brown v. Board of Education, like this historic, we'll remember this like we remember 9/11?
This is an historic decision, and it will be like Brown against Board of Education in the following way. The day after Brown against Board of Education, there was not an immediate solution to the problem of racism in this country. It took 10 years to work out the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. This is an important decision, but part of its importance is not only that it rejected these extreme claims of presidential power, but that it will provoke, for the first time, a serious conversation on the steps we should take in the future.
That was constitutional law professor Bruce Ackerman. His latest book is titled Before the Next Attack, published by Yale University Press. Mexico's presidential election ended with uncertainty on July 2nd. Both leading candidates, conservative Felipe Calderón of the ruling pro-corporate Conservative National Action Party, or PAN, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the center-left Party of Democratic Revolution, or PRD, declared victory when a preliminary vote count showed that less than one percentage point separated the two. As Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute prepared to begin an official count on July 5th, López Obrador, who was trailing by about 400,000 votes in the initial tally, charged that 3 million votes were missing and demanded a vote-by-vote recount. The progressive candidate, who campaigned with the slogan, "For the good of everyone, the poor first," has reason to be fearful of vote fraud. His party's candidate in 1988, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, was widely believed to have had his presidential victory stolen by the then-dominant Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI. López Obrador's own candidacy was almost derailed by dubious contempt of court charges leveled at him by incumbent President Fox of Calderón's party. When confronted with evidence of injustice in the past, López Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico City, has called his supporters into the streets by the hundreds of thousands to challenge opponents. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Letteri, a research fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who was in Mexico City to observe the election. He discusses the campaign and the fear that a protracted contested election could trigger political and civil unrest.
It was clear several, at least 2 years ago, that the leading candidate for the presidency was Mexico City Mayor Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who was wildly popular and really right through January held a commanding lead in the race. All the opinion polls put him above 40%. He was just dominating the race. Calderon came into the race as a bit of an unknown and really fought his way into a pretty much dead heat with Lopez Obrador, largely through a very aggressive attack ad campaign, which he mounted over the spring. And this ad campaign really consisted of comparing Lopez Obrador to Hugo Chavez, calling Lopez Obrador a danger to Mexico, and really playing on the worst fears of the Mexican electorate. So that led up right until really the last debate, which was on June 6th. And at that debate, Lopez Obrador revealed that Calderon had a brother-in-law who had the brother-in-law's company had not been paying taxes, and there were a whole series of corruption allegations, which were magnificently timed by the Lopez Obrador campaign and really dealt Calderon a major blow in the weeks before yesterday's vote. And it really looked to many observers that Lopez Obrador was going to win fairly handily, that it was going to be a clear victory for his campaign. So when the results late Saturday afternoon started coming in, there was a little bit of chagrin in the Lopez Obrador camp because they were not seeing the resounding victory they had hoped to see. And by 9 o'clock that night, there were no exit polls that were really being publicized by the television stations because it was simply too close to call. And that led up to the situation when the head of the Electoral Institute, Luis Carlos Ugalde, came on the air and told the nation that they would not announce a winner that night. The country would have to wait until Wednesday for the Federal Electoral Institute to begin a full count. That very tense moment led to two more very tense moments as Lopez Obrador and Calderon both went up to the stage for their press conference and said, "We are confident in our victories and will respect the official results, but we have won." And that's basically where we stand today. The results of the preliminary reporting system have been trickling in over the course of the day, and Calderon has maintained about a 1 percentage point lead, which really suggests that the race is closer than anybody imagined. And that's basically where the country is right now, waiting to see how this will all play out.
Michael Letieri, what are some of the concerns that Mexicans have about a contested election? There is a history of theft of elections in Mexico, and going back to 1988, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, the standard bearer of the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the same party as Lopez Obrador is running on, by many accounts had that election stolen from him, and then there was a succession of assassinations of his party activists. Is there concern that this may lead to violence, given that history?
There is certainly a concern. The left in Mexico has a long history of not only having elections stolen, but then violent repression following any attempts to protest that fraud. So there is definitely concern here, especially given Lopez Obrador's ability to mobilize large groups of people. In 1994, Lopez Obrador lost the governorship of the state of Tabasco to Roberto Madrazo, who was actually this year's pre-candidate for the presidency. And following that loss, which was a blatant fraud by all accounts, Lopez Obrador organized a massive march to Mexico City, where they occupied the central plaza, the Zocalo, for, I believe, several weeks, sort of to publicize this fraud. There is certain concern that if Lopez Obrador does not receive an official triumph, he would potentially mount large-scale social mobilizations that could potentially end in violence, and even if they don't end up being violent, could be very destabilizing to the country.
Whether Lopez Obrador wins this election or not, how do you think that will affect the general trend of progressive candidates being elected throughout Latin America? There was the expectation that Lopez Obrador would win and would sort of concretize what's already going on throughout South America.
Well, I think the truth is, if you look at simply who the president of Mexico is and say, well, that's the indication of the way the country went in either it's going against or it's going with this so-called pink tide, this leftist trend, that's a pretty gross oversimplification of the situation. Because what you have seen in Mexico already, so regardless of Lopez Obrador winning or not, is that the PRD has catapulted itself to being the second largest political force in the country behind the PAN, is in a position to mount a strong opposition in both the Chamber of Deputies, to a lesser extent in the Senate, where the PAN won a crushing majority. So the PRD really has revealed that there is an ascendant left in Mexico. Whether it's succeeded in gaining the presidency or not, it has become a serious political force in this country.
That was Michael Letteri, a research fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, reporting from Mexico City. Contact the Council at area code 202-223-4975 or visit their website at www.coha.org. Major U.S. newspapers revealed on June 23rd that after the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government had, without congressional oversight, gained secret access to a Belgian banking company's international financial transaction records in an effort to detect transfers of funds between terrorist groups. The reports published in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal dealt with the broad outlines of the program and not the operational details. President Bush condemned the disclosure as disgraceful. Vice President Cheney declared that the reports would make it more difficult to prevent future terrorist attacks against the American people. Conservative politicians and commentators singled out the New York Times for their harshest attacks, some labeling the news reports as treasonous. Republican Representative Peter King of New York demanded that the Times reporters be jailed if they refused to reveal their sources. New York Times executive editor Bill Keller defended his decision to publish the story, noting that his paper had in the past withheld news stories at the request of the White House. He suggested that the attacks on the Times were politically motivated in an important election year. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with BBC investigative reporter and author Greg Palast. He examines the New York Times' occasionally cozy relationship with the Bush administration and the danger posed by government attacks on a free press.
First of all, the idea that Osama bin Laden doesn't realize that checking account transactions are being followed is absurd. Like the New York Times article came out and someone said, "Oh, Osama, stop using the ATM card because they're tracking it now." Who's zooming who, as Aretha Franklin would say. Come on now. He knows that. So number one, I have to say that following these financial transactions, it may not have anything to do with the war on terror, by the way. And what really disturbs me is not what the New York Times reported, but I have to tell you what they haven't reported. Remember that the New York Times are the characters that ran the Judith Miller propaganda that said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The New York Times has always been a good conduit for the official prevarication. Now, suddenly, they're getting off the plantation a bit, and therefore they're being beat up and punished. But I have to remind your listeners, our BBC team found indications that there was a failure of this administration to track the money to Al-Qaeda flowing out of Saudi Arabia, the money to Al-Qaeda, the money to Pakistan to build the Islamic bomb, which then became, of course, the North Korean Islamic bomb and the Libyan bomb. The New York Times had that information. They wouldn't cover it, nor were the rest of the networks. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for the New York Times, but they're quickly finding out what happens when you suddenly decide to report news. You get clonged over the head for just reporting the news.
Well, Greg, is the attacks on the New York Times in the wake of their story about the financial surveillance program are pretty stinging. I mean, you've got Congressman Peter King, a Republican of New York, saying the reporter should be arrested, thrown in jail. There are other Republican commentators and legislators who are saying this is a treason. How dangerous does this get in terms of, our First Amendment rights, the freedom of the press?
Well, the First Amendment rights say that, there's a free press, but the press itself isn't free. That is, you got to own the press. One of the problems, once again, is the commercial censorship of the news. So it's more game of intimidation. That is, we've got a problem. of self-censorship by our news reporters who are afraid of making waves and being cut out of so-called access to the White House. I don't have any access. I don't want any access. I don't want any access to propaganda. I don't want to be the conduit for nonsense. I just want to look at the documents. Yeah, it's very dangerous stuff. I mean, I work in Britain under an Official Secrets Act, which officially censors my material. But at least I don't have the commercial restrictions. I'd rather have the legal restrictions almost. But yeah, and the great irony is, of course, not irony, the great hypocrisy is that, for example, one of the characters running around on Fox News who's talking about the treason of letting Osama know that we're checking his checking accounts, which is a bit nuts, is a former CIA agent, Wayne Simmons, who has been making a fortune for himself and making a big name for himself on Fox TV by talking about all the cool secret stuff that he's been doing. Basically, Fox TV has been a greater conduit of information about what our CIA is up to and its secret methods than the New York Times ever has been. But it's just that they give it a different spin on how wonderful, brilliant, and heroic our secret agents are, as opposed to the reality, which is closer to Keystone Cops.
There are many people looking at what's going on with the attacks on the New York Times and saying, this is just part of the Republican game plan for the 2006 November election. But I'm wondering if you think this goes deeper than that, and the political operatives of the Republican Party are really trying to gut the First Amendment.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. What's happening here is the implicit threat, and maybe even more explicit, is that reporters that get out of line will no longer be allowed to ask questions at the White House. I mean, I think one of the scariest things was not the attack on the Time, but the attack on Helen Thomas, who was a reporter for the AP, for decades had been always the first reporter to ask a question of the president at a press conference, and when she didn't bow down to George Bush and said he wasn't the brightest bulb in the chandelier, they physically, I mean, this woman's like, was in her 70s, and they moved her to the back, they kind of lifted her up and shoved her to the back of the room and won't let her ask a single question. They might as well shackle her and put masking tape over her face. So, I mean, what they're basically saying is get out of line, you lose your access, and then in American networks, that means you lose your job.
That was BBC reporter and author Greg Palast. His new book is titled Armed Madhouse. Read his articles online at gregpalast.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.